The Saudi-Emirati relationship went into overdrive amidst the 2011 protests that rocked political establishments across the Arab world. Their closer alliance was a serious attempt to build up a unified front against any revolutionary movement in the region. To some extent, it was this fear of revolution and those who fanned its flames that finally resulted in the blockade of Qatar in 2017. Spearheaded by Riyadh and Abu Dhabi, the blockade meant to dissuade Doha from supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, a movement considered by many as the main force behind what they call the Arab Spring. The rapid rise of young Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia and his close friendship with the ambitious Crown Prince of the UAE made the two countries take a more adventurous, aggressive path in the region.
We have to know that the relationship between Saudi Arabia, represented by MBS, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and the Emirate, represented by MBZ or MBZ, Mohammed bin Zayed, those countries' relationship are based on the friendship of their respective rulers. And now, after like a honeymoon, long honeymoon, this honeymoon is coming to an end.
The immediate result was a bloody campaign against the poorest country in the region, under the excuse of reinstating the fugitive president of Yemen. All these factors, along with the enmity with Iran, kept the two Arab powers close to each other for about 10 years. But now the so-called Arab Spring has largely passed, and revolutionary sentiment appears mostly on the margins of the internet than in street protest. As anti-state challenges began to fade, a split of opinions began to appear on how to deal with pro-revolutionary groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and, by extension, Qatar. In January 2021, Riyadh announced the end of the blockade on Qatar, a move Abu Dhabi didn't welcome warmly. The Emiratis have yet to restore a full-time ambassador to Doha. In Yemen, strategic realities have also begun to set in. At first, the Emiratis and the Saudis were equally committed to fighting with the Ansarullah movement. But as the war went on, Abu Dhabi decided that the war was more a Saudi problem and therefore became less willing to expend the troops and treasure on the campaign. The decision consequently led to a certain amount of bad blood between the two sides. Things could turn for the worse in Yemen, especially as the UAE-backed Southern Transitional Council continues to seek secession from Yemen, which Saudi Arabia wants to keep unified. Meanwhile, the two countries' attempts to diversify their oil-dependent economies have triggered a kind of economic friction. In tourism, Saudi Arabia hopes to copy Dubai's luxury lure and, if possible, overtake it. With similar climates and attractions, Saudi Arabia and the UAE have found themselves in a fierce rivalry in attracting tourists. Mega projects such as Jeddah Tower and the futuristic town of Neom have been designed to lure businesses and workers away from the glitzy malls of Dubai. Saudi Arabia is also pursuing new transport and infrastructure projects, threatening well-established Emirati companies. Its new national airline, for instance, is striving to muscle out Dubai's Emirates airline market share. The Saudis are also growing ports along the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf, hoping to unseat Jebel Ali on the southern outskirts of Dubai, which acts as the logistical linchpin between Asia and Europe.
It's not new, but publicly now it's in the open. But before, no, it wasn't. It's not new. It's like started by differences like since the war in Yemen, and who is in the lead, who wants to be in the lead. And secondly, one sanction opposed on Qatar also, or the relations between Jebel Ali, especially, or Emirate, and trading with Iran. there were like so many differences between Emirates and Saudi Arabia, but now it comes to an open publicly.
In February 2021, Saudi Arabia warned it would terminate state contracts with businesses that didn't have their regional headquarters in the kingdom, a desperate act to force them move from the UAE.
This will weaken the Emirates' economy, and especially when Saudi Arabia asked the big international companies to come back from Emirates, and because Saudi Arabia is much wider and bigger, merchant for investors to invest. So this will, economic-wise, will bother Emirates a lot.
A few months later, in July 2021, Riyadh imposed tariffs on goods produced in free zones or with Israeli involvement. Policy decisions that directly affect the free zone heavy, Israel-friendly United Arab Emirates. A more overt attempt by Riyadh to limit the Emirates' gains from normalization with Israel. On the other hand, at OPEC, the Emiratis have been more willing to break with the Saudis to gain the production level they want, a sign of growing rift between the two sides.
Saudi Arabia is saying that by extending the oil production, the oil price will go down. And we need it to be stable. And that's why you have OPEC Plus, like the 22 countries is like with Saudi Arabia in this manner. But Emirates has another point of view. They said, okay, we lost so much like money and our economy is a little bit tight. So we need to extend our oil production, like increase our portion of oil production daily. But that will make the oil price, as according to Saudi opinion, will make the oil price go down again. This is the main problem, main issue. So it's also economic-wise, and it is related, especially when UAE is very related economy to the oil production. It's like more than 30% of its economy depends on oil production.
As the UAE-Saudi axis deteriorates, so has the hard line against Iran. Bin Salman's language in Iran has softened dramatically since his rise as the Saudi crown prince. Likewise, the UAE has been busy patching up with Iran. All in all, the growing divergence of interests between Riyadh and Abu Dhabi has created serious cracks in the thin layer of their strategic entente, as it used to be hailed. Although the two sides might continue to agree on some major strategic matters, Riyadh and Abu Dhabi are expected to chart different courses in the coming decade. In fact, overlapping economic competition and strategic differences have already marked an end to a decade of unprecedented alliance.
In the limelight. Claire Mosley, the founder of Care for Calais, said, targeting vulnerable asylum seekers is an act of extreme cowardice. UK government must support people seeking asylum to integrate into our communities rather than putting them in places like Napier barracks or large hotels. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Diane Taylor and Mark Townsend. The piece is titled UK Home Office Records 70 Racist Incidents by Far Right at Asylum Accommodation. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to a Freedom of Information response obtained by The Guardian, the UK Home Office has recorded 70 racist incidents by far-right supporters against asylum seekers in barracks and hotel accommodation. However, campaigners supporting asylum seekers in such accommodation say the figure is a significant underestimation of the true picture. The data, which covers 1st of January 2020 until 13th of July this year, involves incidents in the much-maligned Napier and Penally barracks, which have been under intense scrutiny by MPs after their untenable conditions were revealed, as well as a large-scale COVID outbreak in the former. Penally Barracks in Pembrokeshire, Wales, was closed in March, despite only being opened in September of 2020, along with Napier in Folkestone, Kent. Hotels have been used throughout the period, but their use for asylum seekers increased sharply after the start of the COVID pandemic in March of 2020. In Napier Barracks, 4 incidents were recorded between September and December of 2020, with 12 occurring so far this year. This is despite the barracks being temporarily emptied in April after the coronavirus outbreak. There are now thought to be 176 asylum seekers living there. Several incidents at Penally Barracks was reported to the Home Office last year, and many in 2021. Witness statements from legal challengers by asylum seekers living there reveal a catalogue of disturbing episodes, including an attempt to ram a refugee with a car. Others include stones and bottles being thrown, rape threats, attempts to start fights, fireworks shot through the gate, and eggings. According to witness statements, a farm shop in the area said some of the far-right supporters had asked to buy pigeon scarers to mimic the sound of gunfire and frightened asylum seekers. The number of incidents recorded in hotels has tripled this year, with 40 examples reported, up from 13 last year. Saturday, 7th of August, the far-right organisation Britain First posted a video on its website headlined "Britain First Exposes an Illegal Immigrant Hotel in Hull," in which members of the organisation say they posed as journalists to confront asylum seekers. One asylum seeker from Yemen experienced 2 incidents involving far-right protesters at his Home Office-provided hotel on the outskirts of London. He said, "They were driving around the hotel recording us on video," adding, "They were insulting us, swearing at us, and screaming things like, 'Go out from our country. Why are you eating our food? Go away from us. You are strangers here.' We were too scared to go outside the hotel and felt like it was a prison. We had to stay inside." He added, "We fled countries where there is war and destruction and felt safe when we arrived here. But when we saw this kind of racist attack, we felt we were not protected." Maddie Harris of Humans for Rights Network said, "Ghettoizing people seeking safety in large-scale accommodation such as hotels and army barracks exposes them to harm. The figures shown here are not an accurate representation of the level of racial abuse endured by the people we support. We have had numerous conversations with asylum seekers where they have told us how unsafe they feel due to frequent incidents of racial abuse and that they have experienced in and around these accommodations." Claire Mosley, the founder of Care for Calais, said, "Targeting vulnerable asylum seekers is an act of extreme cowardice. Our government must support people seeking asylum to integrate into our communities rather than putting them in places like Napier barracks or large hotels." A Home Office spokesperson said, "It is unacceptable for anyone in asylum accommodation to experience hostile or racist incidents, and we ensure each incident is thoroughly investigated. We work closely with a range of organizations to ensure immediate support and assistance is provided to people living in the accommodation, and if needed, escalate to law enforcement." Meanwhile, European citizens who have applied for settled status are being detained and threatened with deportation, a development that contradicts assurances from ministers and appears to contravene the Brexit withdrawal agreement. The Home Office has served European Union nationals with removal directions, even though they could prove they had applied for settled status, which should protect their rights to remain in the United Kingdom. Ministers have repeatedly promised that anyone who had applied by the 30th of June deadline would have their existing rights protected while their case was being heard. The apparent failure to honour the agreement has prompted accusations of either administrative incompetence by the Home Office officials or a willful attempt to deport as many European Union nationals as possible, on the assumption they're easier to remove, for instance, than asylum seekers. A letter from the legal charity Bail for Immigration Detainees to the head of Immigration Enforcement, dated 29th of July, raises concerns over the Home Office's failure to acknowledge receipt of settled status applications in cases where it wants to deport European Union citizens. Bail for Immigration Detainees says that unless a meaningful response is received from the Home Office, it will make an official complaint to the European Commission. Lawyers argue it marks an important battle to protect the rights of European Union nationals following Brexit. They warn that the failure to acknowledge applications could potentially affect thousands of individuals. Recently, an EU citizen from the Home Office wanted to deport and who had been detained in an immigration removal centre secured their release on bail after a judge accepted that they could not be removed because they had made an European Union Settlement Scheme application. Even so, the Home Office still contested their release and offered no apology or explanation why it had earlier argued there was no evidence of the application at a previous hearing and therefore could deport them. Speaking shortly after being released, the European Union national who requested anonymity told The Observer, "They're trying to play with mine and my family's lives and it's not fair. I'm supposed to have rights." Pierre McClough, legal director of Bail for Immigration Detainees, said, "It seems that the Home Office has pre-decided the fate of certain European Union nationals, perhaps believing that they're easy to remove. But in its drive to deport more people, it is sidestepping legal requirements and legal procedures. The issue appears to relate mostly to applications sent by post instead of being forwarded digitally." Aranea Kogolathos, a barrister and legal manager of BIDS EEA, European Economic Area Project, said, "Paper applications were used by many vulnerable and marginalized people, including the elderly and those in detention or prison, who found it difficult to access computer or didn't have access to a valid identity document. The numbers affected could be significant. For instance, out of 1,500 inmates at Wandsworth Prison in South London, almost 500 are believed to be European Union nationals." Barrister Aranea Kogolathos said, "Despite having made the European Union Settlement Scheme applications, European Economic Area nationals are being deprived of their liberty and even served with removal directions, both of which they are forced to challenge despite limited access to legal advice and legal representation."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إن كلام الحكماء إذا كان صوابا كان دواء وإذا كان خطأ كان داء.
Imam Ali stated, "When the utterance of the wise is to the point, it serves as a cure. But if it is wrong, it proves to be an illness." Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, there is a very important and a great lesson which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and that is the fact that this world is a deception. And we must be very careful to not be deceived by the world, by the materialism and the physical luxuries and material luxuries of this world. So after the martyrdom of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful, we find that an individual by the name of Dirar ibn Damara, he heads for Syria. When he reaches Syria, he finds that Muawiyah wants to have a meeting with him, Muawiyah, who was the governor of Syria at the time. So Muawiyah knew that this guy, Dirar ibn Damara, was a devotee and a follower of Imam Ali. And so Muawiyah asks him to describe Imam Ali. At first, Dirar says that he does not want to describe Imam Ali and that it is not possible for a person to be able to describe the greatness of Ali, but Muawiyah insists. And so Dirar says, "Listen carefully. I take God as my witness that in the middle of the night, and also when the stars were about to disappear, I saw Ali holding his beard in his hands, and like one bitten by a snake, he wept bitterly, saying, 'O world, go and deceive someone else, for I am not fond of you.' Nevertheless, if you are offering yourself to me, you are quite mistaken, for I have divorced you 3 times, giving you no chance of return. O world, know that your life is short, your worth is little, and your pleasure is transient." So, dear friends, we find that the world and its pleasures and its glamour and its fake material extravagance is something which is a deception which unfortunately leads towards the disobedience of Allah. It leads towards the depths of hell. It leads to somewhere where we do not want to be. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
For the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger." For protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet.
(Speaking in Hebrew)
And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
The name of Shia that we carry for ourselves as a mark of identity is a blessed name. Understand its worth and value. This is a name given by Rasulullah to Ali and those who follow Ali. But let me talk about this name from a different perspective. Normally we identify ourselves as Muslims. A Muslim is someone who follows Rasulullah. But we also say that a Muslim who believes Imam Ali to be the immediate successor of Rasul is a Shia. So we are Shia Muslim. This is how we identify ourselves. And the word Shia literally means follower. Shi'atu Ali, that was our full name. Gradually it became, you know, short form. Like when Rasulullah came to Medina in after the Hijrah, the name of that city from Yasrib changed to Madinatul Nabi, the city of the Prophet. But gradually people just started saying Medina, 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 and the last part was forgotten. Initially we were known as Shi'atu Ali, the followers of Ali. But gradually, because of the usage of the name, whenever you say Shia now, without even saying Shi'atu Ali, the scholars as well as the lay people know that it refers to the Shia of Ali. So you would look at these two names, Muslim and Shia. Is there any negativity about it? No. The first name, Muslim, all Muslims take pride in relating themselves to Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. You know, these days we have so many interfaith dialogue with Christians and Jewish people, and we say we are all three religions part of the Abrahamic faith, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Judaism started with Musa alayhi salam, Christianity started with Isa alayhi salam. When Quran came later on, you know, Quran talks about the dispute between the Ahl Kitab, between the Yahud and the Nasara. Some of them used to say, oh, Ibrahim is Yahudi. The other would say, no, Ibrahim is Nasrani. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala revealed an ayat in Surah Ali Imran, ayat number 67. He says, ma kana Ibrahim Yahudiyan wala Nasraniyan. Ibrahim came before Musa and Isa. He was not a Yahudi, nor was he a Nasrani. وَلَكِنْ كَانَ حَنِيفًا مُسْلِمًا. Not the Muslim in the name of the follower of Rasul, rather somebody who submits himself in a true sense to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Ibrahim was not a Yahudi, neither a Nasrani, وَلَكِنْ كَانَ حَنِيفًا مُسْلِمًا. He was a pure Muslim who submitted to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وَمَا كَانَ مِنَ الْمُشْرِكِينَ. He was not from the mushrikeen. So it's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who gave this name Muslim to Ibrahim alayhi salatu wa salam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now. Thank you.
in the limelight.
Parts of the United Kingdom have again faced rain and localized flooding, but forecasters have said a drier and sunnier summer could be possible by the end of the month. The article you're about to hear has been written by the London Evening Standard journalist Elmira Tanatarova. The piece is titled Areas Hit by Flooding as Torrential Rain Sweeps Across Parts of UK. Parts of the UK have again faced rain and localised flooding, but forecasters have said a drier and sunnier summer could be possible by the end of the month. The dismal summer weather continued on Saturday, 7th of August, with parts of London and Glasgow flooded due to heavy rain, and the Met Office warning that torrential rain will continue to affect the southeast of England throughout the day. There are also warnings of heavy rain, thunderstorms, flooding, lightning strikes, cold winds and hail in central and southern Scotland, in northern England and Northern Ireland for this weekend. There is hope that summer may not be over, with drier conditions forecast for later in the month. Videos and photographs of heavy flooding on the roads and drains full of water were posted on social media by people in Walthamstow in northeast London and Battersea in south London, and two London Underground stations, Stepney Green and Holborn, closed due to the flooding, as well as a platform at Liverpool Street station. There was also flooding in Drumchapel, Glasgow, with one video posted on Twitter showing a car abandoned by its owners under a railway bridge. However, it is likely the weather will clear up for a chance at a drier summer towards the end of August. Met Office meteorologist Becky Mitchell told the Press Association news agency it's going to stay quite changeable at least for the next week, but as we head towards the end of August, there's likelihood we'll see hotter spell of weather and drier, more settled weather across the whole of the United Kingdom. While it is too early to predict temperatures at this stage, it could potentially be in the high 20s. Meteorologist Becky Mitchell said that even though it may not seem like it, this summer has been warmer and drier than average. She said, it's not been wetter on average, but we've seen a lot of reports on the news about flooding. That's why it may feel like a bad summer with not much warmth or sunshine. She explained that the only exception has been the southeast of England, which has been wetter than usual and has already had 111% of its average rainfall for the summer. Becky Mitchell added, the cause of the torrential rain and thunderstorms is down to the fact that July was so hot. She said, we've had quite a lot of warm weather and there was a heat wave during the middle part of July. The end of that heat wave triggered a lot of thunderstorms and heavy and intense rain, which is what brought some of those flooding incidents across parts of the southeast of England. There has been a lot of rainfall in a short amount of time, creating localized flooding events rather than it being a wet period. The worst hit places appear to be the City of London, which has had 143% of its average rainfall this summer, the Isle of Wight, with 174% of its average summer rainfall, and Surrey, with 126% of its average rainfall. Becky Mitchell believes the Isle of Wight will only get rainier and imagines the percentage will be much higher by the end of the summer. By comparison, Scotland has only had 38% of its average rainfall, and Becky Mitchell says a few northern areas have been much, much drier.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Let It Fall, LA 1982 to 1992, directed by John Ridley. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Suresh Grover, who is the director of the Monitoring Group, which is a leading anti-racist charity here in the UK that promotes civil rights. Now, Let It Fall provides an in-depth look at the racial tensions in Los Angeles in the 10 years leading up to the 92 riots, which erupted after the acquittal of four police officers charged in the brutal beating of Rodney King. The riots caused a lot of destruction in the streets of LA, which resulted in the deaths of more than 50 people, who were mostly black, injured over 2,000, and caused at least $1 billion worth of damages.
Los Angeles police officially reprimanded police chief Darrell Gates.
We were having deaths from the chokehold.
He didn't get along with the community.
In the early 80s, the street gangs started to connect with the drug dealers.
It just got out of control.
Karen Tashima was killed in gang crossfire.
This is something that you always see on the news, and this time it happened to us.
We are determined to take back the streets of Los Angeles.
Operation Hammer was a free ticket to go out there and do overly aggressive police work.
What I witnessed at the scene was 100% LAPD policy.
Soon Ja Do, found guilty of killing a 16-year-old girl, received no jail time.
She got away with murder.
Black and brown people are being beat up, shot, choked to death by police forces all over this country.
We, the jury, find the defendant not guilty.
Not? You just disrespect us like this? Like our lives don't matter?
Not guilty, the verdict for all of them.
We were sort of stunned.
We need to back out of here before we have to use deadly force.
It's like pouring gasoline and striking a match. It's not protest anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
I was a part of a movement, a black movement. There's a Florence and Normandy in every city and every state.
It was just one of those days compassion wasn't handed out to other races.
God told me they're gonna save them, save that man's life.
You talked about guerrilla warfare, and it's right here.
18-year-old Edward Song Lee was shot to death.
It doesn't seem real. It felt like it couldn't be happening to us.
I know the anger, and I know exactly what my people are feeling.
We've lost the city. It's gone.
I want to know why God let this happen.
Unity. Empowerment. They're not just cliches. We have to get ourselves together.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. Very much welcome here. And when you watch this documentary, you feel an overwhelming sense of injustice against black people in the US. And another thing that's striking about this documentary is that it's an oral history as told through many different perspectives and angles, through police officers, jurors, and a whole host of others, the victims and families of the victims. And Lee, if I can start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you've sort of identified what makes it unique and what makes it particularly probing is it's an inside story. So the filmmakers, they don't go to pundits and people from the outside. Every single person you hear from was within the story. They're part of the story, whether they're perpetrators or victims or police or, you know, lost loved ones. And that and keeping to that very tight focus, I think, really, I mean, it obviously up to the emotional side of the stories because people are talking about their direct personal involvement. But it gives you that unique perspective because we're not trying to hear from, you know, professors and cultural critics outside it. We stay very much within the story. And I think that's a really great move. The other thing that's great is he doesn't identify who's who. Mm. So you start hearing from people. You might then find that they were a policeman who was, you know, inflicted some violence, or, you know, an African American who was involved in, you know, hurting a white American. And by doing that and saving the sort of the revelation, you get to just hear who these people are before you, otherwise you might just immediately identify them as, oh, racist police officer, mm-hmm. or, you know, violent African American. And of course, what you're hearing is a more sort of multifaceted side to each of these stories, and I think that's a real strength in the film.
That is indeed a great strength, and you hear their personal stories, and I enjoyed that progression, and you feel a connection to all these characters. And Suresh, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Let It Fall?
I think it's a rich history, almost a forensic examination of a decade before the so-called uprisings. I wouldn't call it, I use the word uprising, and there's a reason for it. And I think it tries to focus on what took place, what incidents took place, which led to the build-up of the riots, which is very important. The context is very, very important. And even in this country, when there are public disturbances taking place, people only look at one trigger moment mm-hmm. that started the stuff, rather than the history of relationship between the black communities and the police, for example.
So you're saying this context, this build-up is very important.
The context is absolutely critical. I mean, you know, the police commissioner's views about baton charges, metal baton charges, choke holes, and he tries to describe black people not suffering as much as the white people in terms of that. It's just sheer racism, in my view. It unmasks the real relationship between the authorities mm-hmm. and people who live in the area, who took part in it and who survived in it.
Of course, LA was a very iconic city, it still is, but particularly at that time because of the Olympics, and they even had their first black mayor. So who would know underneath the surface that all this racial tensions was bubbling?
Well, I think what he's trying to point out is that it's enmasked it, but actually people who live in it know exactly what's happening, including the police office and the mayor and the police commissioner. So although the story in cinematic terms is being told through different eyes, mm. what is clear is that the bubble and the bubbling and the simmering and of dissent and the relationship souring between different authorities is actually very, very open and pertinent, mm. and people are turning a blind eye to it. For example, you know, the chokehold is being criticized by everyone. It's actually made illegal. So what do the police do? Instead of decreasing their powers, they increase their powers by using a metal baton. And they use both taser and, I mean, you.
And I'll have to pause you there. We'll go into that a bit more detail later on.
One of the many issues that came up during his time as a chief was the chokehold. It was a controversy for a long, long time in the media.
The Los Angeles Police Commission late today officially reprimanded Police Chief Darrell Gates for comments he made last month about black people and a police restraint method.
Chief Gates said, in some blacks, when it is applied, the veins or arteries do not open up as fast as they do in normal people.
That's asinine. That's insanity. That I still to this day can't believe someone said that. And, of course, that raised a firestorm.
There is a direct parallel between the disproportionate killing of black people in this city and the irresponsible remarks of the chief of police.
There was truly shocking comments made by the LAPD police chief at the time, Darrell Gates. And of course, we learn a bit later on in the documentary that he refused to apologize for those comments. And he gave a sort of apology for people being offended, which is hardly an apology. Lee, what was your reactions watching those comments being made?
Well, I mean, they're horrific, and Darrell Gates. I mean, this area and this time in American history and leading up to the riots, there's been a number of films made on this in the last few years, and so the film goes over. You know, if you're familiar with those films, a lot of familiar ground. So Darrell Gates has been vilified, very rightly so, a lot of the time. What's very interesting about this film is there's a section towards the end where they show that his son himself was addicted to drugs. And it's not letting him off the hook in any shape or form, but it's giving you another side to this person who is very easy otherwise to just demonize as, you know, the big bad guy. And don't get me wrong, his policies and his, you know, his stance is you know, you can't justify it in any way. Mm-hmm. But what's really interesting about the film is it tries to sort of look at people from different angles and maybe give facets of them you didn't know about without excusing it. But, you know, you go, okay, well, then this guy has some other issues going on at the time. Now, again,
that
doesn't excuse it.
That is a very complex story.
But it's really trying to look at things from, a wider angle than you maybe have seen in the past.
And, Suresh, would you agree with what Lee said just there? What did you make of these comments being made?
Life is complicated. People are very complicated. I've been in riots in Southall in the 70s, and I know people are complicated. But to justify, I'm not saying Lee is justified. I don't want to give an air of justification. To me, the comment about the chokehold and not apologizing was sheer racism, and there's no excuse for it. He's a senior police officer. He's a senior police officer who should be held accountable for his comments and his practices and procedures. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's a human being, but we are beyond that in that environment. So when I live in areas like Southam, which is where I come from, which is Hyderabad, I expect police officers to be totally professional. What I don't expect them to do is to blame the victim or the communities that are victimized by police officers because of their racism. And it's happened not just to black people. I did a case of Blair Peach, who was killed by the SPG in 1979. You know what the police said? He had a thin cranium, that's why he died. Mm. And they used a lead-gauge baton to kill him in 1979. Mm. In Mark Duggan's case, what did they say? Honest but mistaken belief. So there's a justification that takes place perpetually by the mainstream and politicians. I do not want to excuse that. Yeah. That doesn't mean, cinematically, people can't look at the complicated picture and come to a resolution. Mm-hmm. But our society is divided between people who have power and who don't have power.
That's
really important to look at.
And Lee, I want to ask you, in picking up on your point, do you think Ridley was sympathetic in any way to the riots through this film? Do you get the idea that the police are in fact the problem, that the riots or uprisings didn't happen out of a vacuum, that people just became crazy one day?
No, I mean, the whole 10-year time frame, as Suresh has noted, it gives you the context and it gives you a lot of understanding of why tensions within the communities and between the police and not just the African-American community, the Korean-American community, Japanese-American, mm-hmm. It's a very, diverse picture that this film paints. I think Ridley is very, he's an interesting figure because he's kind of known as a bit of a polemicist. Mm-hmm. He wrote a very controversial piece for a magazine about 10 years ago using the N-word and criticizing his own community. Mm-hmm. With 12 Years a Slave, which he wrote
the
screenplay for.
Yeah,
him and the director had a big falling out. And I was surprised, actually, at how much empathy this shows. It's not his usual kind of, mode of speaking, if you like. He's very much into controversy, usually, and stirring things up. And I felt that this was a much more restrained and, trying to be more empathetic to look at it. He doesn't let anybody off the hook. So as I said, you don't identify some of the people speaking, and then you find that actually some of these guys were the guys who dragged the white truck driver out of the van and nearly killed him. Mm-hmm. Similarly with the police, you see some people making some very, reasonable statements, and you find out they're absolutely part of the endemic racism of the LA police force. So I was very interested at getting that sort of, empathetic thing. And again, without letting anybody off the hook, and there is clear racism going on there without any shadow of a doubt.
Of course, and it's interesting that so many interpretations can come out of this, and I guess that's a testament to the documentary. And Lee, as we heard in the documentary, one of the police officers in charge at the time told his police officers to avoid that area. Were they effectively then abandoning their duty to protect and serve?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly no expert on police tactics and what you should and shouldn't do, but there was a very clear, decision taken to pull out, and obviously that creates a vacuum, and that allows a lot more things potentially to go on that maybe would be restricted if there was a police presence there. But I mean, this is just part of the chaos. I mean, what it does, it really gives you a picture of the absolute chaos that happened within those 2 days. I was actually in LA probably a couple of weeks after these events, and I was actually walking around through South Central LA. I'd never been in a sort of supposedly peaceful community that had such an air of foreboding and tension. And so it was still, just absolutely in the air, really, really unnerving. So I can only imagine what it would have been like on the 2 days in question. Again, that's no excuse not to get the police in there, because that effectively is their job, to try and maintain, some sort of, so that things don't just descend into utter chaos.
But
it obviously had a huge impact on the events of those 2 days.
And Suresh, why didn't the police go to the area? Were you surprised by their reaction? Were they intimidated by the riots?
I wasn't surprised at all by the reaction. It's a very common police practice in a public disturbance to leave an area on its own. Public disturbances and riots raise a number of issues. And one of them is, why is it that law-abiding citizens living in that area destroy their town?
But they have genuine grievances.
I've been involved, as I said, I've participated in public disturbances. The trigger for me has been racists coming in and the police not stopping them, and then the police arresting us on a continuous basis. And
so the victims,
there's
instead
a time
of the
bomb
perpetrators.
That comes. And when you are there, you realize the danger that exists. You realize the chaos that exists. You realize that you live in the area and you're breaking up a shop and that you're fighting with the police. You actually realize it's very conscious. It's not as if it's unconscious and there's God, nobody's in control. It's frightening. And it's only people who participate in it, who want to create a message, actually win the day. So you create those areas where the police can't enter for a specific period, for a specific reason. And that is to say that if we are not hurt, and after all, even according to, you know, the apostle of peace, Martin Luther King, riots are the voices of the unheard, mm-hmm. which is actually what they are. Yes, you have sterile areas created by the police. In the same way, you have policing of what you call saturation policing, which they talk about in the earlier period, which is indiscriminate arrests at certain times to create fear in community.
It was Project Hammer, I think, they called it in the documentary, Operation Project Hammer.
Yeah, I mean, in this country, they call it saturation policing. Mm-hmm. And we've, in BRICS.
Well, we'll just pause there for now, as John Ridley talking during an ABC radio interview with Amnon Nawaz about the prospect of another uprising.
Worry there could be similar kinds of level of riots or uprisings and
absolutely
that? Yeah,
you know, look, whether how the scope and scale, how big they are, how pervasive they are, you know, again, you know, Los Angeles is a city, how it was policed, and I don't even mean the psychology of it, just the numbers, the demographics, what the capacities were, that's very, very different. It was very, very singular. So I have no doubt in terms of interactions, in terms of what happens in communities, how we look at each other, you know, that we know. I mean, we just know that there are issues. Whether that results in a large-scale uprising, whether it results in a few individuals spilling out on the streets, mm-hmm. whether that is a public demonstration where police and citizenry are going out together to say, look, there's an issue and we got to deal with it, or whether it's just people who feel like they're fed up. You know, how it happens, what the results are, that I can't predict, but I'm absolutely sure that there are stress points, that there are people who feel like they're being marginalized, they're not being listened to somewhere right now, and they are going to want recourse. We need to make sure that that recourse is positive, it's real engagement, because otherwise, you know, when you take away people's voices, when you take away their ability to be heard, they will make themselves heard in any way that they feel is appropriate.
Lee, you were just saying earlier how much of an activist Ridley is. What did you make of his comments there in that radio interview?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. You know, historically, he's done these, you know, he's had these moments where people have been very critical of what he's done. People change. And I think he would probably say that he's not the same filmmaker or maybe even person that he was when he did these other projects. And fair play to him. You know, if we're discussing this particular film, I think it's a really balanced,